This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents The Namesake by Jhumpa Lahiri. Read for you by Sarita Chowdhury. The reader should realize himself that it could not have happened otherwise, and that to give him any other name was quite out of the question. Nikolai Gogol, The Overcoat. On a sticky August evening, 2 weeks before her due date, Ashima Ganguly stands in the kitchen of a Central Square apartment, combining Rice Krispies and Planters peanuts and chopped red onion in a bowl. She adds salt, lemon juice, thin slices of green chili pepper, wishing there were mustard oil to pour into the mix. Ashima has been consuming this concoction throughout her pregnancy, a humble approximation of the snack sold for pennies on Calcutta sidewalks and on railway platforms throughout India, spilling from newspaper cones. Even now that there is barely space inside her, it is the one thing she craves. Tasting from a cupped palm, she frowns. As usual, there's something missing. She stares blankly at the pegboard behind the countertop where her cooking utensils hang, all slightly coated with grease. She wipes sweat from her face with the free end of her sari. Her swollen feet ache against speckled gray linoleum. Her pelvis aches from the baby's weight. She opens a cupboard, the shelves lined with a grimy yellow and white checkered paper she's been meaning to replace, and reaches for another onion, frowning again as she pulls at its crisp, magenta skin. A curious warmth floods her abdomen, followed by a tightening so severe she doubles over, gasping without sound, dropping the onion with a thud to the floor. The sensation passes, only to be followed by a more enduring spasm of discomfort. In the bathroom, she discovers on her underpants a solid streak of brownish blood. She calls out to her husband, Ashok, a doctoral candidate in electrical engineering at MIT, who is studying in the bedroom. He leans over a card table, the edge of their bed, two twin mattresses pushed together under a red and purple batik spread, serves as his chair. When she calls out to Ashok, she doesn't say his name. Ashima never thinks of her husband's name when she thinks of her husband, even though she knows perfectly well what it is. She has adopted his surname, but refuses, for propriety's sake, to utter his first. It's not the type of thing Bengali wives do. Like a kiss or caress in a Hindi movie, a husband's name is something intimate and therefore unspoken, cleverly patched over. And so, instead of saying Ashok's name, she utters the interrogative that has come to replace it, which translates roughly as, "Are you listening to me?" At dawn, a taxi is called to ferry them through deserted Cambridge streets, up Massachusetts Avenue and past Harvard Yard to Mount Auburn Hospital. Ashima registers, answering questions about the frequency and duration of the contractions, as Ashok fills out the forms. She is seated in a wheelchair and pushed through the shining, brightly lit corridors, whisked into an elevator more spacious than her kitchen. On the maternity floor, she is assigned to a bed by a window, in a room at the end of the hall. She is asked to remove her Murshidabad silk sari in favor of a flowered cotton gown that, to her mild embarrassment, only reaches her knees. A nurse offers to fold up the sari, but, exasperated by the 6 slippery yards, ends up stuffing the material into Ashima's slate-blue suitcase. Her obstetrician, Dr. Ashley, gauntly handsome in a Lord Mountbatten sort of way, with fine sand-color hair swept back from his temples, arrives to examine her progress. The baby's head is in the proper position, has already begun its descent. she is told that she is still in early labor, 3 centimeters dilated, beginning to efface. "What does it mean, dilated?" she asks, and Dr. Ashley holds up 2 fingers side by side, then draws them apart, explaining the unimaginable thing her body must do in order for the baby to pass. The process will take some time, Dr. Ashley tells her. Given that this is her first pregnancy, labor can take 24 hours, sometimes more. She searches for Ashok's face, but he has stepped behind the curtain the doctor has drawn. "I'll be back," Ashok says to her in Bengali, and then a nurse adds, "Don't you worry, Mr. Ganguly. She's got a long ways to go. We can take over from here." Now she is alone, cut off by curtains from 3 other women in the room. One woman's name, she gathers from bits of conversation, is Beverly. Another is Lois. Carol lies to her left. "God damn it, God damn you, this is hell," she hears one of them say, and then a man's voice, "I love you, sweetheart." Words Ashima has neither heard nor expects to hear from her own husband. This is not how they are. It is the first time in her life she has slept alone, surrounded by strangers. All her life she has slept either in a room with her parents or with Ashok at her side. She wishes the curtains were open so that she could talk to the American women. Perhaps one of them has given birth before, can tell her what to expect. But she has gathered that Americans, in spite of their public declarations of affection, in spite of their miniskirts and bikinis, in spite of their hand-holding on the street and lying on top of each other on the Cambridge Common, prefer their privacy. She spreads her fingers over the taut, enormous drum her middle has become, wondering where the baby's feet and hands are at this moment. The child is no longer restless. For the past few days, apart from the occasional flutter, she has not felt it punch or kick or press against her ribs. She wonders if she is the only Indian person in the hospital, but a gentle twitch from the baby reminds her that she is, technically speaking, not alone. Ashima thinks it's strange that her child will be born in a place most people enter either to suffer or to die. There is nothing to comfort her in the off-white tiles of the floor, the off-white panels of the ceiling, the white sheets tucked tightly into the bed. In India, she thinks to herself, women go home to their parents to give birth, away from husbands and in-laws and household cares, retreating briefly to childhood when the baby arrives. Another contraction begins, more violent than the last. She cries out, pressing her head against the pillow. Her fingers grip the chilly rails of the bed. No one hears her. No nurse rushes to her side. She has been instructed to time the duration of the contractions, and so she consults her watch, a Bon Voyage gift from her parents, slipped over her wrist the last time she saw them, amid airport confusion and tears. It wasn't until she was on the plane, flying for the first time in her life on a BOAC VC-10, whose deafening ascent 26 members of her family had watched from the balcony at Dum Dum Airport. As she was drifting over parts of India she'd never set foot in, and then even farther, outside India itself, that she'd noticed the watch among the cavalcade of matrimonial bracelets on both her arms, iron, gold, coral, conch. Now, in addition, she wears a plastic bracelet with a typed label identifying her as a patient of the hospital. She keeps the watch face turned to the inside of her wrist, on the back surrounded by the words waterproof, anti-magnetic, and shock protected, her married initials, A.G., are inscribed. American seconds tick on top of her pulse point. For half a minute, a band of pain wraps around her stomach, radiating toward her back and shooting down her legs. And then, again, relief. She calculates the Indian time on her hands. The tip of her thumb strikes each rung of the brown ladders etched into the backs of her fingers, then stops at the middle of the third. It is 9.5 hours ahead in Calcutta, already evening. 8:30. In the kitchen of her parents' flat on Amherst Street, at this very moment, a servant is pouring after-dinner tea into steaming glasses, arranging Marie biscuits on a tray. Her mother, very soon to be a grandmother, is standing at the mirror of her dressing table, untangling waist-length hair, still more black than gray, with her fingers. Her father hunches over his slanted, ink-stained table by the window, sketching, smoking, listening to the Voice of America. Her younger brother Rana studies for a physics exam on the bed. She pictures clearly the gray cement floor of her parents' sitting room, feels its solid chill underfoot even on the hottest days. An enormous black-and-white photograph of her deceased paternal grandfather looms at one end against the pink plaster wall. Opposite, an alcove shielded by clouded panes of glass is stuffed with books and papers and her father's watercolor tins. For an instant, the weight of the baby vanishes, replaced by the scene that passes before her eyes, only to be replaced once more by a blue strip of the Charles River. Thick green treetops, cars gliding up and down Memorial Drive. In Cambridge, it is 11 in the morning, already lunchtime in the hospital's accelerated day. A tray holding warm apple juice, jello, ice cream, and cold baked chicken is brought to her side. Patty, the friendly nurse with the diamond engagement ring and a fringe of reddish hair beneath her cap, tells Ashima to consume only the jello and the apple juice. It's just as well. Ashima would not have touched the chicken, even if permitted. Americans eat their chicken in its skin, though Ashima has recently found a kind butcher on Prospect Street willing to pull it off for her. Patty comes to fluff the pillows, tidy the bed. Dr. Ashley pokes his head in from time to time. "No need to worry," he chirps, putting a stethoscope to Ashima's belly, patting her hand, admiring her various bracelets. "Everything is looking perfectly normal. We are expecting a perfectly normal delivery, Mrs. Ganguly." But nothing feels normal to Ashima. For the past 18 months, ever since she's arrived in Cambridge, nothing has felt normal at all. It's not so much the pain, which she knows somehow she will survive. It's the consequence. Motherhood in a foreign land. For it was one thing to be pregnant, to suffer the queasy mornings in bed, the sleepless nights, the dull throbbing in her back, the countless visits to the bathroom. Throughout the experience, in spite of her growing discomfort, she'd been astonished by her body's ability to make life, exactly as her mother and grandmother and all her great-grandmothers had done. That it was happening so far from home, unmonitored and unobserved by those she loved, had made it more miraculous still. But she is terrified to raise a child in a country where she is related to no one, where she knows so little, where life seems so tentative and spare. "How about a little walk? It might do you good," Patty asks when she comes to clear the lunch tray. Ashima looks up from a tattered copy of Desh magazine that she'd brought to read on her plane ride to Boston, and still cannot bring herself to throw away. The printed pages of Bengali type, slightly rough to the touch, are a perpetual comfort to her. She's read each of the short stories and poems and articles a dozen times. There is a pen and ink drawing on page 11 by her father, an illustrator for the magazine. A view of the North Calcutta skyline sketched from the roof of their flat one foggy January morning. She had stood behind her father as he had drawn it, watching as he crouched over his easel, a cigarette dangling from his lips, his shoulders wrapped in a black Kashmiri shawl. "Yes, all right," Ashima says. Patty helps Ashima out of bed, tucks her feet one by one into slippers, drapes a second nightgown around her shoulders. "Just think," Patty says as Ashima struggles to stand. "In a day or two, you'll be half the size." She takes Ashima's arm as they step out of the room into the hallway. After a few feet, Ashima stops, her legs trembling as another wave of pain surges through her body. She shakes her head, her eyes filling with tears. "I cannot." You can squeeze my hand, squeeze as tight as you like. After a minute, they continue on, toward the nurse's station. Hoping for a boy or a girl? Patty asks. As long as there are 10 finger and 10 toe, Ashima replies. For these anatomical details, these particular signs of life are the ones she has most difficulty picturing when she imagines the baby in her arms. Patty smiles, a little too widely, and suddenly Ashima realizes her error. No, she should have said fingers and toes. This error pains her almost as much as her last contraction. English had been her subject. In Calcutta, before she was married, she was working toward a college degree. She used to tutor neighborhood school children in their homes, on their verandas and beds, helping them to memorize Tennyson and Wordsworth, to pronounce words like sign and cough, to understand the difference between Aristotelian and Shakespearean tragedy. But in Bengali, a finger can also mean fingers, a toe, toes. It had been after tutoring one day that Ashima's mother had met her at the door, told her to go straight to the bedroom and prepare herself. A man was waiting to see her. He was the third in as many months. The first had been a widower with 4 children. The second, a newspaper cartoonist who knew her father, had been hit by a bus in Esplanade and lost his left arm. To her great relief, they had both rejected her. She was 19, in the middle of her studies, in no rush to be a bride. And so, obediently, but without expectation, she had untangled and rebraided her hair, wiped away the coal that had smudged below her eyes, patted some cuticura powder from a velvet puff onto her skin. The sheer parrot-green sari she pleated and tucked into her petticoat had been laid out for her on the bed by her mother. Before entering the sitting room, Ashima had paused in the corridor. She could hear her mother saying, "She is fond of cooking, and she can knit extremely well. Within a week, she finished this cardigan I'm wearing." Ashima smiled, amused by her mother's salesmanship. It had taken her the better part of the year to finish the cardigan, and still her mother had had to do the sleeves. Glancing at the floor where visitors customarily removed their slippers, she noticed, beside 2 sets of chappals, a pair of men's shoes that were not like any she'd ever seen on the streets and trams and buses of Calcutta, or even in the windows of Bata. They were brown shoes with black heels and off-white laces and stitching. There was a band of lentil-sized holes embossed on either side of each shoe, and at the tips was a pretty pattern pricked into the leather as if with a needle. Looking more closely, she saw the shoemaker's name written on the insides, in gold lettering that had all but faded. "Something and Sons," it said. She saw the size, 8.5, and the initials, USA. And as her mother continued to sing her praises, Ashima, unable to resist a sudden and overwhelming urge, stepped into the shoes at her feet. Lingering sweat from the owner's feet mingled with hers, causing her heart to race. It was the closest thing she had ever experienced to the touch of a man. The leather was creased, heavy, and still warm. On the left shoe, she had noticed that one of the crisscrossing laces had missed a hole, and this oversight set her at ease. She extracted her feet, entered the room. The man was sitting in a rattan chair, his parents perched on the edge of the twin bed where her brother slept at night. He was slightly plump, scholarly-looking, but still youthful, with black, thick-framed glasses and a sharp, prominent nose. A neatly trimmed mustache, connected to a beard that covered only his chin, lent him an elegant, vaguely aristocratic air. He wore brown socks and brown trousers, and a green and white striped shirt, and was staring glumly at his knees. He did not look up when she appeared. Though she was aware of his gaze as she crossed the room, by the time she managed to steal another look at him, he was once again indifferent, focused on his knees. He cleared his throat as if to speak, but then said nothing. Instead, it was his father who did the talking, saying that the man had gone to St. Xavier's and then B.E. College, graduating first class from both institutions. Ashima took her seat and smoothed the pleats of her sari. She sensed the mother eyeing her with approval. Ashima was 5 feet 4 inches, tall for a Bengali woman, 99 pounds. Her complexion was on the dark side of fair, but she had been compared on more than one occasion to the actress Madhabi Mukherjee. Her nails were admirably long, her fingers, like her father's, artistically slim. They inquired after her studies, and she was asked to recite a few stanzas from The Daffodils. The man's family lived in Alipur. The father was a labor officer for the customs department of a shipping company. "My son has been living abroad for 2 years," the man's father said, "earning a PhD in Boston, researching in the field of fiber optics." Ashima had never heard of Boston or of fiber optics. She was asked whether she was willing to fly on a plane and then if she was capable of living in a city characterized by severe, snowy winters, alone. "Won't he be there?" she'd asked, pointing to the man whose shoes she'd briefly occupied, but who had yet to say a word to her. It was only after the betrothal that she'd learned his name. 1 week later, the invitations were printed, and 2 weeks after that she was adorned and adjusted by countless aunts, countless cousins hovering around her. These were her last moments as Ashima Baduri, before becoming Ashima Ganguly. Her lips were darkened, her brow and cheeks dotted with sandalwood paste, her hair wound up, bound with flowers, held in place by 100 wire pins that would take an hour to remove once the wedding was finally over. Her head was draped with scarlet netting. The air was damp, and in spite of the pins, Ashima's hair, thickest of all the cousins, would not lie flat. She wore all the necklaces and chokers and bracelets that were destined to live most of their lives in an extra-large safety deposit box in a bank vault in New England. At the designated hour, she was seated on a piri that her father had decorated, hoisted 5 feet off the ground, carried out to meet the groom. She had hidden her face with a heart-shaped betel leaf, kept her head bent low until she had circled him 7 times. 8,000 miles away in Cambridge, she has come to know him. In the evenings, she cooks for him, hoping to please, with the unrationed, remarkably unblemished sugar, flour, rice, and salt she had written about to her mother in her very first letter home. By now, she has learned that her husband likes his food on the salty side, that his favorite thing about lamb curry is the potatoes, and that he likes to finish his dinner with a small final helping of rice and dal. At night, lying beside her in bed, he listens to her describe the events of her day. Her walks along Massachusetts Avenue, the shops she visits, the Hare Krishnas who pester her with their leaflets, the pistachio ice cream cones she treats herself to in Harvard Square. In spite of his meager graduate student wages, he sets aside money to send every few months to his father to help put an extension on his parents' house. He is fastidious about his clothing. Their first argument had been over a sweater she had shrunk in the washing machine. As soon as he comes home from the university, the first thing he does is hang up his shirt and trousers, donning a pair of drawstring pajamas and a pullover if it's cold. On Sundays, he spends an hour occupied with his tins of shoe polishes and his 3 pairs of shoes, 2 black and 1 brown. The brown ones are the ones he'd been wearing when he'd first come to see her. The sight of him cross-legged on newspaper spread on the floor, intently whisking a brush over the leather, always reminds her of her indiscretion in her parents' corridor. It is a moment that shocks her still, and that she prefers, in spite of all she tells him at night about the life they now share, to keep to herself. On another floor of the hospital, in a waiting room, Ashok hunches over a Boston Globe from a month ago, abandoned on a neighboring chair. He reads about the riots that took place during the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, and about Dr. Benjamin Spock, the baby doctor, being sentenced to 2 years in jail for threatening to counsel draft evaders. The Favor Luba, strapped to his wrist, is running 6 minutes ahead of the large gray-faced clock on the wall. It is 4:30 in the morning. An hour before, Ashok had been fast asleep, at home, Ashima's side of the bed covered with exams he'd been grading late at night, when the telephone rang. Ashima was fully dilated and being taken to the delivery room, the person on the other end said. Upon arrival at the hospital, he was told that she was pushing, that it could be any minute now. Any minute. And yet, it seemed only the other day, one steel-colored winter's morning, when the windows of the house were being pelted with hail, that she had spit out her tea, accusing him of mistaking the salt for sugar. To prove himself right, he had taken a sip of the sweet liquid from her cup, but she had insisted on its bitterness and poured it down the sink. That was the first thing that had caused her to suspect, and then the doctor had confirmed it. And then he would wake to the sounds every morning when she went to brush her teeth of her retching. Before he left for the university, he would leave a cup of tea by the side of the bed, where she lay listless and silent. Often, returning in the evenings, he would find her still lying there, the tea untouched. He now desperately needs a cup of tea for himself, not having managed to make one before leaving the house. But the machine in the corridor dispenses only coffee, tepid at best, in paper cups. He takes off his thick-rimmed glasses, fitted by a Calcutta optometrist, polishes the lenses with the cotton handkerchief he always keeps in his pocket, A for Ashok, embroidered by his mother in light blue thread. His black hair, normally combed back neatly from his forehead, is disheveled, sections of it on end. He stands and begins pacing, as the other expectant fathers do. So far, the door to the waiting room has opened twice, and a nurse has announced that one of them has a boy or a girl. There are handshakes all around, pats on the back, before the father is escorted away. The men wait with cigars, flowers, address books, bottles of champagne. They smoke cigarettes ashing onto the floor. Ashok is indifferent to such indulgences. He neither smokes nor drinks alcohol of any kind. Ashima is the one who keeps all their addresses in a small notebook she carries in her purse. It has never occurred to him to buy his wife flowers. He returns to the globe, still pacing as he reads. A slight limp causes Ashok's right foot to drag almost imperceptibly with each step. Since childhood, he has had the habit and ability to read while walking, holding a book in one hand on his way to school, from room to room in his parents' three-story house in Alipore, and up and down the red clay stairs. Nothing roused him. Nothing distracted him. Nothing caused him to stumble. As a teenager, he had gone through all of Dickens. He read newer authors as well, Graham Greene and Somerset Maugham, all purchased from his favorite stall on College Street with puja money. But most of all, he loved the Russians. His paternal grandfather, a former professor of European literature at Calcutta University, had read from them aloud in English translations when Ashok was a boy. Each day at tea time, as his brothers and sisters played kadabi and cricket outside, Ashok would go to his grandfather's room, and for an hour his grandfather would read supine on the bed, his ankles crossed and the book propped open on his chest. Ashok curled at his side. For that hour, Ashok was deaf and blind to the world around him. He did not hear his brothers and sisters laughing on the rooftop, or see the tiny, dusty, cluttered room in which his grandfather read. "Read all the Russians, and then reread them," his grandfather had said. "They will never fail you." When Ashok's English was good enough, he began to read the books himself. It was while walking on some of the world's noisiest, busiest streets on Chorengi and Guriahat Road that he had read pages of The Brothers Karamazov and Anna Karenina and Fathers and Sons. Once, a younger cousin, who had tried to imitate him, had fallen down the red clay staircase in Ashok's house and broken an arm. Ashok's mother was always convinced that her eldest son would be hit by a bus or a tram, his nose deep into War and Peace, that he would be reading a book the moment he died. One day, in the earliest hours of October 20th, 1961, this nearly happened. Ashok was 22, a student at BE College. He was traveling on the 83 Up Howrah Ranchi Express to visit his grandparents for the holidays. They had moved from Calcutta to Jamshedpur upon his grandfather's retirement from the university. Ashok had never spent the holidays away from his family. But his grandfather had recently gone blind, and he had requested Ashok's company specifically to read him The Statesman in the morning, Dostoevsky and Tolstoy in the afternoon. Ashok accepted the invitation eagerly. He carried two suitcases, the first one containing clothes and gifts, the second empty. For it would be on this visit, his grandfather had said, that the books in his glass-fronted case, collected over a lifetime and preserved under lock and key, would be given to Ashok. The books had been promised to Ashok throughout his childhood, and for as long as he could remember, he had coveted them more than anything else in the world. He had already received a few in recent years, given to him on birthdays and other special occasions. But now that the day had come to inherit the rest, a day his grandfather could no longer read the books himself, Ashok was saddened, and as he placed the empty suitcase under his seat, he was disconcerted by its weightlessness, regretful of the circumstances that would cause it, upon his return, to be full. He carried a single volume for the journey, a hardbound collection of short stories by Nikolai Gogol, which his grandfather had given him when he had graduated from class 12. On the title page, beneath his grandfather's signature, Ashok had written his own. Because of Ashok's passion for this particular book, the spine had recently split, threatening to divide the pages into two sections. His favorite story in the book was the last, The Overcoat. And that was the one Ashok had begun to reread as the train pulled out of Howrah Station late in the evening with a prolonged and deafening shriek, away from his parents and his six younger brothers and sisters, all of whom had come to see him off and had huddled until the last moment by the window, waving to him from the long, dusky platform. He had read The Overcoat too many times to count. Certain sentences and phrases embedded in his memory. Each time he was captivated by the absurd, tragic, yet oddly inspiring story of Akaki Akakievich, the impoverished main character who spends his life meekly copying documents written by others and suffering the ridicule of absolutely everyone. His heart went out to poor Akaki, a humble clerk just as Ashok's father had been at the start of his career. Each time, reading the account of Akaki's christening and the series of queer names his mother had rejected, Ashok laughed aloud. He shuddered at the description of the tailor Petrovich's big toe, with its deformed nail as thick and hard as the shell of a tortoise. His mouth watered at the cold veal and cream pastries and champagne Akaki consumed the night his precious coat was stolen, in spite of the fact that Ashok had never tasted these things himself. Ashok was always devastated when Akaki was robbed in a square that looked to him like a dreadful desert, leaving him cold and vulnerable. And Akaki's death, some pages later, never failed to bring tears to his eyes. In some ways, the story made less sense each time he read it, the scenes he pictured so vividly and absorbed so fully growing more elusive and profound. Just as Akaki's ghost haunted the final pages, so did it haunt a place deep in Ashok's soul, shedding light on all that was irrational, all that was inevitable about the world. Outside, the view turned quickly black, the scattered lights of Howrah giving way to nothing at all. He had a second-class sleeper in the seventh bogey, behind the air-conditioned coach. Because of the season, the train was especially crowded, especially raucous, filled with families on holiday. Small children were wearing their best clothing, the girls with brightly colored ribbons in their hair. Though he had had his dinner before leaving the station, a four-layer tiffin carrier packed by his mother sat at his feet. in the event that hunger should attack him in the night. He shared his compartment with three others. There was a middle-aged Bihari couple, who he gathered from overhearing their conversation, had just married off their eldest daughter, and a friendly, pot-bellied, middle-aged Bengali businessman wearing a suit and tie by the name of Ghosh. Ghosh told Ashok that he had recently returned to India after spending 2 years in England on a job voucher, but that he had come back home because his wife was inconsolably miserable abroad. Ghosh spoke reverently of England, the sparkling empty streets, the polished black cars, the rows of gleaming white houses, he said, were like a dream. Trains departed and arrived according to schedule, Ghosh said. No one spat on the sidewalks. It was in a British hospital that his son had been born.
Seen much of this world?
Ghosh asked Ashok, untying his shoes and settling himself cross-legged on the berth. He pulled a packet of Dunhill cigarettes from his jacket pocket, offering them around the compartment before lighting one for himself.
Once to Delhi, Ashok replied, and lately once a year to Jamshedpur.
Ghosh extended his arm out the window, flicking the glowing tip of his cigarette into the night.
Not this world, he said, glancing disappointedly about the interior of the train.
He tilted his head toward the window.
England, America,
he said, as if the nameless villages they passed had been replaced by those countries.
Have you considered going there?
My professors mention it from time to time, but I have a family, Ashok said.
Ghosh frowned.
Already married?
No, a mother and father and 6 siblings. I am the eldest.
And in a few years you will be married and living in your parents' house, Ghosh speculated.
I suppose.
Ghosh shook his head.
You are still young, free, he said, spreading his hands apart for emphasis. Do yourself a favor, before it's too late, without thinking too much about it first, pack a pillow and a blanket and see as much of the world as you can. You will not regret it. One day it will be too late.
My grandfather always says that's what books are for, Ashok said, using the opportunity to open the volume in his hands. To travel without moving an inch.
To each his own, Ghosh said.
He tipped his head politely to one side, letting the last of the cigarette drop from his fingertips. He reached into a bag by his feet and took out his diary, turning to the 20th of October. The page was blank, and on it, with a fountain pen whose cap he ceremoniously unscrewed, he wrote his name and address. He ripped out the page and handed it to Ashok.
If you ever change your mind and need contacts, let me know. I live in Toliganj, just behind the tram depot.
Thank you, Ashok said, folding up the information and putting it at the back of his book.
How about a game of cards? Ghosh suggested. He pulled out a well-worn deck from his suit pocket, with Big Ben's image on the back.
But Ashok politely declined, for he knew no card games, and besides which, he preferred to read. One by one the passengers brushed their teeth in the vestibule, changed into their pajamas, fastened the curtain around their compartments, and went to sleep. Ghosh offered to take the upper berth, climbing barefoot up the ladder, his suit carefully folded away so that Ashok had the window to himself. The Bihari couple shared some sweets from a box and drank water from the same cup without either of them putting their lips to the rim, then settled into their berths as well, switching off the lights and turning their heads to the wall. Only Ashok continued to read, still seated, still dressed. A single small bulb glowed dimly over his head. From time to time, he looked through the open window at the inky Bengal night, at the vague shapes of palm trees and the simplest of homes. Carefully, he turned the soft yellow pages of his book, a few delicately tunneled by worms. The steam engine puffed reassuringly, powerfully. Deep in his chest, he felt the rough jostle of the wheels. Sparks from the smokestack passed by the window. A fine layer of sticky soot dotted one side of his face, his eyelid, his arm, his neck. His grandmother would insist that he scrub himself with a cake of Margot soap as soon as he arrived.
immersed in the sartorial plight of Akaki Akakievich, lost in the wide, snow-white, windy avenues of St. Petersburg, unaware that one day he was to dwell in a snowy place himself, Ashok was still reading at 2:30 in the morning, one of the few passengers on the train who was awake, when the locomotive engine and seven bogies derailed from the broad gauge line. The sound was like a bomb exploding. The first four bogies capsized into a depression along the track. The fifth and sixth, containing the first class and air-conditioned passengers, telescoped into each other, killing the passengers in their sleep. The seventh, where Ashok was sitting, capsized as well, flung by the speed of the crash farther into the field. The accident occurred 209 kilometers from Calcutta, between Gachila and Dalbungar stations. The train guard's portable phone would not work. It was only after the guard ran nearly 5 kilometers from the site of the accident to Gachila that he was able to transmit the first message for help. Over an hour passed before the rescuers arrived, bearing lanterns and shovels and axes to pry bodies from the cars. Ashok can still remember their shouts, asking if anyone was alive. He remembers trying to shout back, unsuccessfully, his mouth emitting nothing but the faintest rasp. He remembers the sound of people half dead around him, moaning and tapping on the walls of the train, whispering hoarsely for help, words that only those who are also trapped and injured could possibly hear. Blood drenched his chest and the right arm of his shirt. He had been thrust partway out the window. He remembers being unable to see anything at all. For the first hours he thought that perhaps, like his grandfather whom he was on his way to visit, he had gone blind. He remembers the acrid odor of flames, the buzzing of flies, children crying, the taste of dust and blood on his tongue. They were nowhere, somewhere in a field. Milling about them were villagers, police inspectors, a few doctors. He remembers believing that he was dying, that perhaps he was already dead. He could not feel the lower half of his body, and so was unaware that the mangled limbs of Ghosh were draped over his legs. Eventually, he saw the cold, unfriendly blue of earliest morning, the moon and a few stars still lingering in the sky. The pages of his book, which had been tossed from his hand, fluttered in two sections a few feet away from the train. The glare from a search lantern briefly caught the pages, momentarily distracting one of the rescuers. "Nothing here," Ashok heard someone say. "Let's keep going." But the lantern's light lingered, just long enough for Ashok to raise his hand, a gesture that he believed would consume the small fragment of life left in him. He was still clutching a single page of The Overcoat, crumpled tightly in his fist, and when he raised his hand, the wad of paper dropped from his fingers. "Wait!" he heard a voice cry out. "The fellow by that book! I saw him move!" He was pulled from the wreckage, placed on a stretcher, transported on another train to a hospital in Tatanagar. He had broken his pelvis, his right femur, and three of his ribs on the right side. For the next year of his life, he lay flat on his back, ordered to keep as still as possible as the bones of his body healed. There was a risk that his right leg might be permanently paralyzed. He was transferred to Calcutta Medical College, where two screws were put into his hips. By December, he had returned to his parents' house in Alipur, carried through the courtyard and up the red clay stairs like a corpse, hoisted on the shoulders of his four brothers. 3 times a day he was spoon-fed. He urinated and defecated into a tin pan. Doctors and visitors came and went. Even his blind grandfather from Jamshedpur paid a visit. His family had saved the newspaper accounts. In a photograph, he observed the train smashed to shards, piled jaggedly against the sky, security guards sitting on the unclaimed belongings. He learned that fish plates and bolts had been found several feet from the main track, giving rise to the suspicion, never subsequently confirmed, of sabotage. that bodies had been mutilated beyond recognition. Holidaymaker's tryst with death, the Times of India had written. In the beginning, for most of the day, he had stared at his bedroom ceiling, at the three beige blades of the fan churning at its center, their edges grimy. He could hear the top edge of a calendar scraping against the wall behind him when the fan was on. If he moved his neck to the right, he had a view of a window with a dusty bottle of Dettol on its ledge, and if the shutters were open, the concrete of the wall that surrounded the house, the pale brown geckos that scampered there. He listened to the constant parade of sounds outside, footsteps, bicycle bells, the incessant squawking of crows and of the horns of cycle rickshaws in the lane so narrow that taxis could not fit. He heard the tube well at the corner being pumped into urns. Every evening, at dusk, he heard a conch shell being blown in the house next door to signal the hour for prayer. He could smell, but not see, the shimmering green sludge that collected in the open sewer. Life within the house continued. His father came and went from work, his brothers and sisters from school. His mother worked in the kitchen, checking in on him periodically, her lap stained with turmeric. Twice daily, the maid twisted rags into buckets of water and wiped the floors. During the day, he was groggy from painkillers. At night, he dreamed either that he was still trapped inside the train, or worse, that the accident had never happened, that he was walking down a street, taking a bath, sitting cross-legged on the floor and eating a plate of food. And then he would wake up, coated in sweat, tears streaming down his face, convinced that he would never live to do such things again. Eventually, in an attempt to avoid his nightmares, he began to read, late at night, which was when his motionless body felt most restless, his mind agile and clear. Yet he refused to read the Russians his grandfather had brought to his bedside, or any novels for that matter. Those books, set in countries he had never seen, reminded him only of his confinement. Instead, he read his engineering books, trying his best to keep up with his courses, solving equations by flashlight. In those silent hours, he thought often of Gauche. "Pack a pillow and a blanket," he heard Gauche say. He remembered the address Gauche had written on a page of his diary, somewhere behind the tram depot in Tullyganj. Now it was a home of a widow, a fatherless son. Each day, to bolster his spirits, his family reminded him of the future, the day he would stand unassisted, walk across the room. It was for this, each day, that his father and mother prayed, for this that his mother gave up meat on Wednesdays. But as the months passed, Ashok began to envision another sort of future. He imagined not only walking, but walking away, as far as he could from the place in which he was born and in which he had nearly died. The following year, with the aid of a cane, he returned to college and graduated, and without telling his parents, he applied to continue his engineering studies abroad. Only after he had been accepted with a full fellowship, a newly issued passport in hand, did he inform them of his plans.
"But we already nearly lost you once," his bewildered father had protested.
His siblings had pleaded and wept. His mother, speechless, had refused food for 3 days. In spite of all that, he had gone. 7 years later, there are still images that wipe him flat. They lurk around a corner as he rushes through the engineering department at MIT, checks his campus mail. They hover by his shoulder as he leans over a plate of rice at dinner time, or nestles against Ashima's limbs at night. At every turning point in his life, at his wedding, when he stood behind Ashima, encircling her waist and peering over her shoulder as they poured puffed rice into a fire, or during his first hours in America, seeing a small gray city caked with snow. He has tried, but failed to push these images away. The twisted, battered, capsized bogies of the train, his body twisted below it, the terrible crunching sound he had heard but not comprehended, his bones crushed as fine as flour. It is not the memory of pain that haunts him. He has no memory of that. It is the memory of waiting before he was rescued, and the persistent fear rising up in his throat that he might not have been rescued at all. To this day, he is claustrophobic, holding his breath in elevators, feels pent up in cars unless the windows are open on both sides. On planes, he requests the bulkhead seat. At times, the wailing of children fills him with deepest dread. At times, he still presses his ribs to make sure they are solid. He presses them now in the hospital, shaking his head in relief, disbelief. Although it is Ashima who carries the child, he too feels heavy with the thought of life, of his life and the life about to come from it. He was raised without running water, nearly killed at 22. Again, he tastes the dust on his tongue, sees the twisted train, the giant overturned iron wheels. None of this was supposed to happen. But no, he had survived it. He was born twice in India, and then a third time in America. 3 lives by 30. For this, he thanks his parents, and their parents, and the parents of their parents. He does not thank God. He openly reveres Marx and quietly refuses religion. But there is one more dead soul he has to thank. He cannot thank the book. The book has perished, as he nearly did, in scattered pieces in the earliest hours of an October day, in a field 209 kilometers from Calcutta. Instead of thanking God, he thanks Gogol, the Russian writer who had saved his life, when Patty enters the waiting room. Chapter 2. The baby, a boy, is born at 5 past 5 in the morning. He measures 20 inches long, weighs 7 pounds 9 ounces. Ashima's initial glimpse, before the cord is clipped and they carry him away, is of a creature coated with a thick white paste and streaks of blood, her blood, on the shoulders, feet, and head. A needle, placed in the small of her back, has removed all sensation from her waist to her knees, and given her a blistering headache in the final stages of the delivery. When it is all over, she begins to shiver profoundly, as if beset with an acute fever. For half an hour she trembles, in a daze, covered by a blanket, her insides empty, her outside still misshapen. She is unable to speak, to allow the nurses to help exchange her blood-soaked gown for a fresh one. In spite of endless glasses of water, her throat is parched. She is told to sit on a toilet to squirt warm water from a bottle between her legs. Eventually, she is sponged clean, put into a new gown, wheeled into yet another room. The lights are soothingly dim, and there is only one other bed next to hers, empty for the time being. When Ashok arrives, Patty is taking Ashima's blood pressure, and Ashima is reclining against a pile of pillows, the child wrapped like an oblong white parcel in her arms. Beside the bed is a bassinet, labeled with a card that says, Baby Boy Ganguly. He's here, she says quietly, looking up at Ashok with a weak smile. Her skin is faintly yellow, the color missing from her lips. She has circles beneath her eyes, and her hair, spilling from its braid, looks as though it has not been combed for days. Her voice is hoarse, as if she'd caught a cold. He pulls up a chair by the side of the bed, and Patty helps to transfer the child from mother's to father's arms. In the process, the child pierces the silence in the room with a short-lived cry. His parents react with mutual alarm, but Patty laughs approvingly. You see, Patty says to Ashima, he's already getting to know you. Ashok does as Patty tells him, stretching out his arms, putting one hand below the neck and another below the bottom. Go on, Patty urges. He wants to be held tightly. He's stronger than you think. Ashok lifts the minuscule parcel higher, closer to his chest. Like this? There you go, Patty says. I'll leave you three alone for a while. At first, Ashok is more perplexed than moved by the pointiness of the head, the puffiness of the lids, the small white spots on the cheeks, the fleshy upper lip that droops prominently over the lower one. The skin is paler than either Ashima's or his own, translucent enough to show slim green veins at the temples. The scalp is covered by a mass of wispy black hair. He attempts to count the eyelashes. He feels gently through the flannel for the hands and feet. It's all there, Ashima says, watching her husband. I already checked.
What are the eyes like? Why won't he open them? Has he opened them?
She nods.
What can he see? Can he see us?
I think so, but not very clearly, and not in full color, not yet.
They sit in silence, the three of them as still as stones.
How are you feeling? Was it all right? He asks Ashima.
But there is no answer, and when Ashok lifts his gaze from his son's face, he sees that she, too, is sleeping. When he looks back to the child, the eyes are open, staring up at him, unblinking, as dark as the hair on its head. The face is transformed. Ashok has never seen a more perfect thing. He imagines himself as a dark, grainy, blurry presence, as a father to his son. Again, he thinks of the night he was nearly killed, the memory of those hours that have forever marked him flickering and fading in his mind. Being rescued from that shattered train had been the first miracle of his life. But here, now, reposing in his arms, weighing next to nothing, but changing everything, is the second. Apart from his father, the baby has three visitors, all Bengali. Maya and Dilip Nandi, a young married couple in Cambridge whom Ashima and Ashok met a few months ago in the Purity Supreme, and Dr. Gupta, a mathematics postdoc from Dehradun, a bachelor in his 50s, whom Ashok has befriended in the corridors of MIT. At feeding times, the gentlemen, including Ashok, step out into the hall. Maya and Dilip give the boy a rattle and a baby book, with places for his parents to commemorate every possible aspect of his infancy. There is even a circle in which to paste a few strands from his first haircut. Dr. Gupta gives the boy a handsome illustrated copy of Mother Goose Rhymes.
Lucky boy, Ashok remarks, turning the beautifully sewn pages. Only hours old and already the owner of books.
What a difference, he thinks, from the childhood he has known. Ashima thinks the same, though for different reasons. For as grateful as she feels for the company of the Nandis and Dr. Gupta, these acquaintances are only substitutes for the people who really ought to be surrounding them. Without a single grandparent or parent or uncle or aunt at her side, the baby's birth, like most everything else in America, feels somehow haphazard, only half true. As she strokes and suckles and studies her son, she can't help but pity him. She has never known of a person entering the world so alone, so deprived. Because neither set of grandparents has a working telephone, their only link to home is by telegram, which Ashok has sent to both sides in Calcutta. With your blessings, boy and mother, fine. As for a name, they have decided to let Ashima's grandmother, who is past 80 now, who has named each of her other 6 great-grandchildren in the world, do the honors. When her grandmother learned of Ashima's pregnancy, she was particularly thrilled at the prospect of naming the family's first sahib. And so Ashima and Ashok have agreed to put off the decision of what to name the baby until a letter comes, ignoring the forms from the hospital about filing for a birth certificate. Ashima's grandmother has mailed the letter herself, walking with her cane to the post office, her first trip out of the house in a decade. The letter contains one name for a girl, one for a boy. Ashima's grandmother has revealed them to no one. Though the letter was sent a month ago, in July, it has yet to arrive. Ashima and Ashok are not terribly concerned. After all, they both know an infant doesn't really need a name. He needs to be fed and blessed, to be given some gold and silver, to be patted on the back after feedings and held carefully behind the neck. Names can wait. In India, parents take their time. It wasn't unusual for years to pass before the right name, the best possible name, was determined. Ashima and Ashok can both cite examples of cousins who were not officially named until they were registered at 6 or 7 in school. The Nandis and Dr. Gupta understand perfectly. Of course you must wait, they agree. Wait for the name in his great-grandmother's letter. Besides, there are always pet names to tide one over. A practice of Bengali nomenclature grants to every single person 2 names. In Bengali, the word for pet name is Daknam, meaning, literally, the name by which one is called, by friends, family, and other intimates, at home, and in other private, unguarded moments. Pet names are a persistent remnant of childhood, a reminder